time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Robert W. Cherney. Robert W. Cherney is professor of history at San Francisco State University. He is the author of multiple books, including the anthology American Labor and the Cold War, Unions, Politics, and Postwar Political Culture, co-edited with William Eisel and Kieran Taylor, American Politics in the Gilded Age, 1868 to 1900, A Righteous Cause, The Life of William Jennings Bryan, San Francisco, 1865 to 1932, Politics, Power, and Urban Development, and San Francisco, Presidio, Port, and Pacific Metropolis, both co-authored with William Eisel, and Populism, Progressivism, and the Transformation of Nebraska Politics, 1885 to 1915. And he is a speaker at today's event celebrating Seattle's striking history that's happening at 1 p.m. today at the Seattle Labor Temple and sponsored by the UW Harry Bridges Center for Labor Studies. Professor Cherney, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
No, thanks for inviting me.
You are speaking today, as I just said, at the Celebrating Seattle Striking History event and going to be talking about the lost history of the Seattle Commune.
Yes.
And I was very intrigued by your subject because I'd never even known that this commune existed. That was the first I was hearing about it.
Well, I think not many people know about it. It was formed by a group of people from this area, from the Pacific Northwest. I know for sure that one of them came from Bellingham, some of them others from as far south as Astoria, Oregon, but concentrated around the Seattle area. In 1921, they put in a proposal to the government in the Soviet Russia. In response to a request by the Soviet government for the international proletariat to come to the assistance of the new Soviet government. In 1921, there were serious problems in parts of Russia, especially the parts that were their agricultural heartland. They'd gone through a serious drought that had driven many people off the land. The Civil War had raged through those parts of Russia. As a result, there was serious famine in Russia in 1921 that brought about worldwide efforts to take food to Russia to help the Russian people. And as one part of that, in October of 1921, the Soviet government offered to give land to people from outside the United States or from outside Russia, including the United States, if they would come to Russia and establish agricultural communes. In the Pacific Northwest, a group of about 90 people decided that they would do that. These were mostly people who had been born in the old Russian Empire. They were immigrants to the U.S. from Finland, from Russia itself, from the Ukraine, from other regions that had been a part of the old Russian Empire. There were a few who were born in the United States, but mostly of those ethnic backgrounds. They put in a proposal to the Soviet government. The Soviet government was receptive and gave them almost 19 square miles of land in the far south of Russia near the port city of Rostov-on-Don, about 100 miles from that port city. So this is a region known as the North Caucasus. It was a region that had been particularly hard hit by the civil war in Russia and by the famine, so that this land was virtually abandoned. It had been all a part of the estate of some noble who had been stripped of his land during the Bolshevik uprising and the subsequent establishment of the Soviet government. So this group of about 90 people headed for Russia in 1922 and established a commune there. It was tough going at first, but over time they were able to make it one of the most productive farms in all of the Soviet Union. They became a showplace, in fact, for visitors from outside Russia to see what it was like to establish socialist agriculture.
Now, how did you get interested in this subject?
Well, I came across it by accident. In 1996, I was a Fulbright lecturer at Moscow State University. I taught American history there for a semester. And while I was there, I took advantage of the fact that the archives of the Communist Party of the United States had been open to researchers. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, a huge archive of the papers of the American Communist Party were opened up to researchers. Very few American researchers had done anything there, and here I was with a whole semester in Moscow, so I started poking around at the papers for the Pacific Coast, California, Washington, Oregon. And I got very interested in doing some of the history of the Communist Party in those three states, because the resources in Moscow were so rich. And eventually I started finding in the California papers requests to transfer their party membership from California to the California colony in southern Russia. And that was the first inkling I had that there was something going on here. So I started pursuing this topic. And eventually I discovered that there were three agricultural communes established by people from the Pacific Coast in the early 20s. The California colony was mostly people from Los Angeles. The San Francisco colony was consisted entirely of members of the Molokan Church from San Francisco. The Molokan Church was a version of Russian Protestantism that had broken away from the Russian Orthodox Church. And then there was the Seattle colony with people from the Pacific Northwest. About a year or so ago, I sent an email to the Fulbright office in Moscow, where I'd kept some contacts over the years, and asked if there was any American who was teaching in Rostov, the nearest big city to where this commune was located. And the Moscow Fulbright office put me in connection with Seth Bernstein, who was teaching English in that area. Seth is now a PhD student in Russian history at the University of Toronto, but he'd been spending 2 years as a Fulbright teacher in Russia as a way of getting his own Russian up to the highest level of proficiency. Seth was very interested in this project and started digging into the Russian archives in that area, and he actually at one point went to visit what's now the village of Seattle, the current version of this commune, the way it developed over the last almost 100 years now.
So what were the conditions when the people went over there in 1922?
Yeah. Well, 1921, the point at which they formulated their proposal for a commune, was the pit of the post-war recession following World War I. There was huge unemployment across the United States. Official unemployment was above 10%. The Seattle newspapers reported that there were 6,000-7,000 men walking the streets of Seattle looking for jobs. It was a difficult time economically in the United States. And so you put this economic hardship that existed in the U.S. together with the opportunity being presented by the Soviet government to take up large amounts of land and establish agricultural communes, you begin to have some understanding as to why people might be interested in taking part in this experiment. The other part of it that I think is important is that for the group from the Pacific Northwest and also the group from Los Angeles, these seem, for the most part to have been dedicated socialists. We don't know this for sure yet. This is the next step in the research, is to find out more about them when they were living in the United States. But my guess is that these were probably all members of the foreign language federations of the Socialist Party before World War I. So they were probably all dedicated socialists, and many of the people who'd been in the foreign language federations of the Socialist Party moved over to the Communist Party after the revolution in Russia and after the establishment of a Communist Party in the United States. So these were people that were also ideologically motivated. They wanted to go to the Soviet Union to help build socialism. These were people who thought that what had been created in Russia was the future. It was the civilization of the future, and they wanted to be a part of creating it.
And my understanding from you sharing one of your papers with me was that the Soviet Union required them to pay a fee prior to coming over.
Well, it wasn't so much paying a fee as getting together some capital, because the Russian government essentially said to them, we'll give you land, we'll give you transportation to get to the land, everything else you have to supply. So to think about farming 19 square miles, I mean, that takes a lot of equipment. And the Russian government laid out specific capital requirements. Everybody who joined the Seattle Commune had to put up $500, which was a lot of money in 1921, 1922. And some of them put up much more than that. So some of them put up as much as $5,000. So what they were doing, clearly, was putting their whole life savings into this operation. Before the group left Seattle, they'd raised $200,000. And if you translate that into purchasing power today, that means they had about $2.3 million in purchasing power from 2009. They used this to buy the very best, most efficient, most powerful American agricultural equipment. So they had a shipload of farm equipment that they took with them, along with enough supplies, clothing, tools, even food to last them for 2 years. That was a requirement by the Soviet government, that if they were going to come and take up the land, they had to come well supplied. They had to come ready to engage in transforming what was really empty steppe into productive farmland.
So talk about their experiences of when they got there and what they had to deal with.
Well, when they arrived, they were expecting that there would actually be some buildings where they could live, because they were told this was the estate of a former noble family. What they found was that most of the buildings were in very sad state of repair. The few that were habitable were lived in by squatters. The squatters were driven out, some by the members of the commune and some by the local authorities. But as a result, and I just discovered this in the last couple of days, by driving out the squatters, they alienated all of the local peasants around them, so that their local neighbors refused to give them any assistance at all for the first couple of years that they were there. So they really had to make do with what they brought with them. One report I found in the archive at the university just yesterday said that the local peasants wouldn't even sell them so much as a chicken for the first 2 years that they were there. Mice got into their clothing on the ship, and when they were coming from the United States to Russia, and ate through a lot of their clothing, so they had to replace all of that. They had the money to do it, but there wasn't supplies easily available to replace all of the things they brought with them. They also discovered that the land they'd been given was swampy in places. And during the first couple of years, as many as two-thirds of them were suffering from malaria much of the time, and that the malaria weakened them so much that it was really difficult to get much work done during those first couple of years, until they were able to get quinine brought from the United States to treat the malaria. They had a really tough time of it. Their farm equipment that was so important to what they were going to do was delayed in transit in Russia, and they didn't get it until about 8 months after they arrived. So they came there, they arrived in October of 1922, and they had planned that they were going to put in winter wheat right away, but they didn't have any equipment, and they were all sick with malaria. So they were very slow in bringing the land under cultivation. Ultimately, they brought most of it under cultivation. They were able to farm almost all of their 19 square miles eventually. And they had a whole brigade of tractors to do this. They continued to bring more American farm equipment over succeeding years. one of their Caterpillar tractors won an award as being the most productive tractor in the entire Soviet Union one year because it was in operation for more continuous hours than any other tractor in the entire country. And they were able to do this because they had the skills to maintain the equipment. You know, these people who had come from the Pacific Northwest included people who had been metal workers, who had been mechanics. We don't know what all of the occupations were, but they clearly included machinists and blacksmiths and mechanics. There they were more than 100 miles from the biggest nearest big city, and in order to maintain their farm equipment, they had to have the ability to actually make replacement parts themselves. They couldn't just order replacement parts from the nearest Caterpillar dealer because the nearest Caterpillar dealer was in the United States. So they had the skill and the tools, the machine tools, in order to keep their machinery running at the most effective level. And they continued to invest in the most modern farm equipment because they did have the capital that they'd brought with them. They had the very first combine in the Soviet Union. So this made them a highly productive agricultural commune by the late 1920s, early 1930s. They became something of a showplace, in fact. Where the Soviet government would bring visitors to show them the successes of socialist agriculture. And they really did organize the whole farm as in a sense an agricultural factory. They lived in, the unmarried members of the commune lived in dormitories, one for men, one for women. There was also quarters for married couples. But they all ate in a common dining hall. They had a common laundry for the entire commune. They had a common bathhouse in the Russian style, a banya, where everyone went for their baths. They had child care set up for all the members of the commune. So it was a very communal lifestyle. It wasn't just that they cooperated in doing the farming. Every aspect of their life was organized communally. And it was organized very effectively. The goal was always to make it possible for the members of the commune to spend the maximum amount of time at work on the work of the commune. We have accounts of the meals in which people would come in, sit down, the meals would be served, they'd eat silently, and they'd be gone within 15 to 20 minutes and back to work. Even meals were organized to make maximum use of the time and to avoid losing time for work.
From my reading of your paper, it didn't sound real happy, though. It didn't sound like a pleasant place. I mean, if you couldn't, you know, talk to people at a meal, that just didn't seem enticing to me.
Well, I had the same reaction in some ways. But I kind of wondered if there might not be other reasons for the mealtime rules of not talking and just getting in and out as quickly as possible. Because what we discovered, or what Seth really discovered in his research in the Russian archives, was that by the almost immediately, beginning in 1922 and continuing until 1930, there was a lot of conflict between the Finns, who made up the large majority of the original members of the commune, and the Slavic speakers, the Russians, the Ukrainians, and the others. And this rule about not talking in the dining hall might well have served two purposes. It meant that they were in and out of there and back to work quickly, and it may have also cut down the opportunities for the kinds of political discussions or other discussions that might have led to further conflict. The conflict took the form of especially of controversy over the leadership of the commune, because the Finns always elected Finns. The Finns had the large majority, so the governing board of the commune almost always consisted of Finns. It wasn't until the mid-20s that they found a commune head. His title was either chairman or president. It's not clear. Both of those terms appear. Who was a Latvian and who was apparently a good compromise between the Finns and the Slavic speakers. and who had no big ethnic constituency of his own. He was the only Latvian in the entire commune, and so he seemed to be acceptable to both the Finns and the Russians, and was a very effective leader for the commune from the mid-20s all the way up until the time the German army overran the commune during World War II and executed him. But there was this ongoing ethnic conflict between the Finns and the others, and ultimately in 1930, about two-thirds of the Finns left. They went to Karelia, which is the part of the Soviet Union next to Finland, where the Soviet government was trying to create a Finnish national homeland for Finns who were living inside the Soviet Union at that point. And at that point, the ethnic conflict seems to have cooled off a lot. After that point, no one group had the overwhelming majority that the Finns had formed up until 1930. It continued to be a multi-ethnic commune with Russians, Ukrainians, Belarusians, Latvians, Lithuanians, Estonians, still some continuing Finns, and at least a few other people from other parts of the world who had joined the commune by that point.
So what finally happened to the commune, and did any of the people involved in it ever return to Seattle?
I think probably some of them did return to Seattle. That's another part of the research we have yet to do. I do know, for example, that the San Francisco commune was closed down in 1927, and they all came back to San Francisco. In the early years of the Seattle commune, there were a number of them who, a number of the people who left, and I would expect that some of them came back. What happened to it eventually was that under strong pressure, well, the direct orders, in fact, from the government in Moscow, they converted it from a commune to a collective farm. That happened in 1940. Collective farms were the official policy of the Russian government for agriculture. They'd managed to resist this conversion for 10 full years, but finally in 1939 the order came from Moscow, you shall do this. And they did. And they voted in 1940 that they would convert themselves to a collective farm. They really had no choice about the vote, but they took a vote because that's the way they did things. And at the same time, they changed their name from Seattle to Stalin, perhaps as a recognition of where the transition had come from. It remained the Stalin farm until after Stalin's death. After Stalin's death, the name of it was changed again. To commemorate a party congress, probably much less politically sensitive than naming somebody after a Russian leader. Some of the Finns came back at that point after Stalin's death. It continued as a collective farm until the collapse of the Soviet Union. We found one newspaper article from 2002 that said that with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the collapse of the collective farms all over Russia, that the Seattle farm had been converted to a joint stock company. So it had become a capitalist enterprise at that point. My guess is that probably the people living there became the stockholders. Because in the transition to capitalism in Russia, there was often stock issued in the socialist enterprises that existed, and I would guess that probably much of the stock in this particular collective farm was given to the people who worked it, and they changed their name again back to Seattle. But I should also mention that from the very beginning, the commune had two names. In English, it was always referred to as Seattle. In Russian, it was referred to as Seyatl, which is a slightly different word. If you transliterate Seattle into Russian, you would use an A, but what they used was a Ya. It's the backward R, which has a Ya sound in Russian. And by using that letter instead of the A, they made a Russian word of it. The Russian word Seyatl means sower, as in a person who sows grain. So it was a very interesting wordplay from the beginning, and you find this the two names in use consistently. Anytime that there was an English language publication. It's referred to as Seattle, but in Russian it's always Seattle, and that's the name that it has today. There's a small village called Seattle that's about 100 miles from Rostov-on-Don that was the center of the old commune.
Only a couple minutes left. So what are you pursuing research-wise on the project now?
Well, Seth and I are continuing to look for more information about the commune. And what I want to do next in this project is to begin to find out more about the life of the commune members before they left the United States. We found a very interesting article by a Russian journalist from 1923 who said, "What an amazing thing this is. Here we have all these people born in the Russian Empire who went to the United States and they came back, and now they're not like Russians at all. They're like people from another planet." So somehow, during their time in the United States, they became very Americanized, so that their Russian neighbors looked upon them as being Americans rather than as being Russians like themselves. I want to find out more about their life in the Seattle area.
All right. Well, unfortunately, a half hour is not enough time to cover this subject, but you're going to be speaking. You're one of the speakers in today's forum event entitled... Where did it go?
Seattle Striking History.
There you go. And that's happening at the Seattle Labor Temple today from 1 to 5 p.m., and it's sponsored by the UW Harry Bridges Center for Labor Studies. So I assume you'll have some time then to do some Q&A with the audience, do you anticipate?
Yep, we'll have question and answer time, and I've got a lot of photographs that Seth collected when he was on the ground there in Seattle last summer. And we'll be showing the photographs of what it actually looked like.
Very good. And do you have a website or anything people can turn to for more information on this?
Well, this isn't on the website yet. We're going to put some of this up on the website eventually, and I expect that maybe Jim Gregory at the university here is going to be doing something more with some of this on his website. He has a website on the Seattle General Strike, and so we may be doing something with his website. But that remains to be done.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
We have just been talking with Professor Robert W. Cherney. He is professor of history at San Francisco State University. And again, he's going to be speaking today during the forum celebrating Seattle's striking history that's happening at the Seattle Labor Temple at 1 p.m. and sponsored by the UW Harry Bridges Center for Labor Studies.